Hello, I'm Bob Harris. Imagine you could put together some of your favourite musicians in a group where egos were checked at the door. A group in which all five members contributed freely to the songs that were recorded within moments of being written. A group who had little time for the epic recording schedules other bands were enduring and instead played in a friend's kitchen. Imagine Charlie T. Jr., Otis, Lefty, Lucky and Nelson, five half-brothers of the Wilbury family.
In reality, they are Tom Petty, Jeff Lynne, Roy Orbison, Bob Dylan and myself. The music business tends to be very serious, but not with these guys.
From Travelling Wilburys Volume 1, released in November 1988. How Bob Dylan, George Harrison, Jeff Lynne, Roy Orbison and Tom Petty formed a group together is down to a little bit of luck and, most importantly, their friendship and mutual respect. George and Bob had co-written a song as far back as 1970 and they'd performed together on stage in 1971 to focus the world's gaze on the plight of Bangladesh. Tom Petty, as the only 30-something, he was the Wilburys' kid brother, had, with his group, the Heartbreakers, also played with Dylan in concert.
We were backing Bob Dylan. George would come visit the shows, and that's where I really got to know George good, you know. And we had some screaming, laughing times, you know. He was a really, really could get you laughing really, really hard, you know. I mean, I've really held my sides and tried not to hurt with him. Some people have a public image of him as this kind of reverent guy, which he was, but he was also really funny. I mean, just rip you apart funny.
Then there was Jeff Lynne. He'd been a member of innovative British beat groups The Idle Race and The Move, and during the 70s had enjoyed international success with the Electric Light Orchestra. In 1987, he found himself working on the first George Harrison album for 5 years, Cloud Nine.
When George asked me to help him with his album, I hadn't done anything right for a couple of years. I'd sort of didn't know what to do. And George said, "Would you like to produce my album with me?" And I said, no, thanks, I'm busy. No, I said, of course I would, I'd love to, you know, it's one of the best things I could wish to do right now, especially being Mrs. George, because I love his stuff.
Precious words drift away from the meaning, and the sun melts the chill from our lives.
While making Cloud Nine, Jeff and George joked about forming a dream group with their musical heroes.
We had this fictitious group that we might have one day called the Trembling Wilburys. It's just like you do in the studio, you know, about 4 o'clock in the morning. And little did we know, it would be the Travelling Wilburys.
Yeah, but at that point, I mean, it was just a drunken thought in the back of the head.
Meanwhile, Jeff was suddenly in demand as a producer.
Tom Petty tracked him down on a road in Los Angeles.
I heard this horn blowing. I was trying to tune in a station on the radio, and I heard this horn keep going. And then it was Tom and his, I always remember, his, in his red Corvette. Hey, Tom. And he says, pull over. So we pulled over. I'd met him in England before, you know, at the Bob Dylan concert that he was playing on. And he said, I've just been playing George's album, and it's great. I said, do you fancy writing a song together up at my house? So I said, yeah, lovely. From one track, it ended up as being, like, 12.
And while Jeff and Tom were collaborating on the Petty solo album Full Moon Fever, they were both writing and recording with rock and roll legend Roy Orbison. And that's when, early in 1988, George came to LA. Of course, we're back in the days when vinyl records were released alongside the newfangled CDs. And at the request of his label, George quickly had to come up with a new song.
Warners needed this third song to put on one of them 12-inch singles. So I didn't have a song, I didn't have an extended version, I didn't have another song, so I just said to Jeff, I was in Los Angeles and he was producing Roy Orbison, and we were having dinner one night, and I said, I'm going to have to write a song tomorrow and just do it, you know. I was just thinking of, like, instant karma, that way. And, you know, I said, we're just going to do it tomorrow, and he said, where could we get a studio? And he said, well, maybe Bob, you know, because he's got this little studio in his garage. And it was that instant, you know, we just went back to his house, phoned up Bob, he said, sure, come on over. Tom Petty had my guitar, and he said, when I went to pick it up, he said, I was wondering what I was going to do tomorrow. And Roy said, well, give us a call tomorrow if you're going to do anything, I'd love to come along. And that was it. We started and wrote this tune the next morning when we got to Dylan's house, just the tune. And then as we were doing that, I thought, well, let's just stick a bit in here for Roy, you know. I was thinking, it's a bit daft having all these people stand around and then I end up singing it again. You know, just get them to sing it. And then when they actually were doing the vocals at one point, I just said to Jeff, hey, Jeff, this is it, the Traveling Wilburys.
Being beat up and battered around, being sent up and I've been shot down. You're the best thing that I've ever found. And reputation's changeable, situation's tolerable, but baby, you're adorable, and no need with care. I'm so tired of being lonely, I still have some love to give. Won't you show me that you really care?
Everybody's got somebody to lean on. Put your body next to mine and dream on.
I've been fucked up and I've been fooled. I've been robbed and ridiculed. In daycare centers and night schools.
It was a good little story on Handle With Care, because we did the tune and we put it down, all the rhythm guitars, just with a click track. And then we needed the words, and I was walking around with a bit of paper and a pencil trying to think of a title, and I was saying, come on, where's the words? Thinking all these people are so great songwriters. Then I'm trying to come up with some titles, and I looked behind this door and there was this big cardboard box that said Handle With Care on it. I said, it's called Handle With Care. And that was it. Once we got the title, it just went off, you know. I just thought, being beat up, battered around, and then the lyrics just were flying around. I mean, we could have had 29 verses to that tune. It was brilliant.
So brilliant, in fact, that not surprisingly, George's record company didn't want to hide it away on a 12-inch single. So now what?
I liked the song and the way it had turned out with all these people on it so much. I just carried it around in my pocket for ages thinking, well, what can I do with this thing? And the only thing to do I could think of was do another nine, make an album. And as it happened, they all said, yeah, you know, they all loved the idea.
Oh, the sweet smell of success.
The final member to be drafted into the group project was Roy Orbison.
We went down to see him at a show in Anaheim. I think it was George, Tom and myself. We went down, watched his show. He killed everybody stone dead, you know, with these great big endings. Fantastic, big numbers, the way they end, you know. It just makes you want to go wild. Yeah, more, you know. We just wanted more as well as all these other regular fans. And we went in the dressing room after the show and asked him if he would like to be in our group.
Roy's wife, Barbara, remembers their excited visit.
When Roy came off stage, George got on his knees. He was really funny. He slid on his knees and he says, "We want to have a band and we want to have you in it. Will you do it?" And Roy said yes. And it was always good. It was just an incredible way of being in a band, because since everybody was equal and none of them really needed the band, you know, everybody came and put their best foot forward. And basically, George was it, you know. George was the manager and the creator and the wheel and the motor.
So the lineup that had made Handle With Care in a garage as a spontaneous one-off reunited in the home studio of another musician friend to make an album. As Bob Dylan was about to leave for a tour, their writing and recording time had to be limited.
We got hold of Dave Stewart's studio in LA. We were actually using the kitchen, which had an ambience to it that we liked for acoustic guitars. Just a bit more of a live room, because I know Dave used to use his studio for all electronics, you know, so there was no really miking up in that room. But the kitchen sounded great, so that's where we tend to record most of the stuff. And went in there for like 2 weeks straight and cut all the other tracks, wrote the track in the afternoon, laid it down in the afternoon, had dinner and wrote the words, and then sang them on the evening. It was quite amazing, actually. It was like the most amazing use of time. My book of How to Write a Tune in a Day: get Roy Orbison, Bob Dylan, George Harrison and Tom Petty, and they'll help you.
He loves your sexy body, he loves your dirty mind, he loves when you hold him, grab him from behind. Oh, baby, you're such a pretty thing, I can't wait to introduce you to the other members of my for you free. Oh, baby, the pleasure be all mine if you let me drive your pickup truck and park it where the sun don't shine. Every time he touches you, his hair stands up on him. Your legs begin to quiver and his mind begins to bend. Oh, baby, you're such a tasty treat. While I'm under doctor's orders, I'm afraid to overeat. He loves your sense of humor, disposition to.
We decided to do this thing about he loves your... He loves you. And then we wrote lists of... I mean, even that was funny. I mean, I don't know how other people write songs, but that bit, I just picked up a bunch of magazines and gave everybody a magazine. And they all just started reading out little things like five-speed gearbox and stuff like that, and just wrote down a big list of things. And then we reduced it down to about 12 that sounded interesting. We just wrote this random list and had it on the microphone. And then we just did the take, and whoever sang first sang the first one, and we just sang round the group until we'd done them all.
And every time it came round to Roy Orbison, he always got the trembling Wilbur. And it was just the funniest thing. Roy, like the big voice, the big operatic, trembling Wilbur. And we all just collapsed every time. And no matter how we rearranged it, he always ended up with trembling Wilbur. I mean,
Drummer Jim Kautner, who'd played with George and Bob for many a year, had been invited along to join the Wilbury party.
I remember one of the most fun nights I had was sitting around the table while they were writing. Of course, I just kept my mouth shut, just wanting to savor every word. I thought I was going to be hearing these amazingly profound lyrics coming from these guys. And I sat there and I laughed so hard because I heard these incredible lyricists saying the silliest things. you know, like rhyming the dumbest sounding things. And so I just thought it was great. And then out of all of that, they came up with these really fun little songs.
There at the bar when I got out of the car.
Oh, no, she was long and tall. She was
short and fat. I thought she was dressed to kill.
Yeah, that's good.
She was to give me a thrill.
She was over the hill.
She was over the hill.
What's that? She was dressed to kill. She was over the hill.
Jim Kautner couldn't resist making good use of the fact that they were recording in the kitchen.
I opened the fridge and I saw all this stuff in there and I thought, oh good, we're going to eat well this afternoon. And then I happened to have my dowel sticks at the time, so I started running them across the grate, the spacers, you know, that hold the eggs and things. And they're made of metal, you know, and they... And anytime I see something like that, being a drummer, I guess I always have to run my fingernail across it or something. But I happened to have the sticks with me at the time. So it created a great little sound, and then somebody made a comment in the background, and then, so then I started playing like a little groove on it, and I noticed that if I moved the eggs back a little bit, I moved the enchiladas over to the side a bit, it tuned those little things. We got kind of silly with it, and then I started playing it more serious and everything. And somebody said, well, let's overdub it, and so that's how that happened. It became a part of the track. It was the song Rattle that we used that sound.
The fridge, I tell you, it's the great new sound, folks. What's happening?
Got a song yet. This was about the fourth or fifth one we did, and I thought, oh, I better sing one, otherwise, you know, nobody know I'm in it. anyway, I sung it, nobody knew I was singing it. Anyway, so it didn't matter. The singing style is like that sort of rock and roll voice that I do sometimes on other records.
Is that like Sun Records to me, that track? You know, the combination, the sound of it, I think, is just so close to a good old rock and roll thing from like the late 50s. But that partially is, I think, the guitars, the acoustics, and the refrigerator.
Rattled, with lead vocal by Jeff Lynne, and featuring Roy Orbison's Oh Pretty Woman Growl. Roy's musical history went further back than any of the other guys in the group. After all, he'd been a label mate of Elvis, Jerry Lee Lewis and Carl Perkins at Sun Records in Memphis during the mid-50s. His first major hit in 1960, Only the Lonely, set the template for a series of powerful ballads that built to a dramatic crescendo. As Jim Keltner recalls, when Roy stepped up to the microphone, his buddies were in a state of awe.
I said, man, this is really incredible. He said, yeah, we're having some fun, aren't we? I said, but you know, Roy, you realize that the only reason this thing is really happening is because of you. Those guys all came together because George got you to do this. And that was the truth. I mean, that actually was the truth. I don't know that they would have actually come together the way they did without Roy. That was my guess anyway at the time. So I said, you know, you're the reason why they put this thing together. And he said, yeah, well, we're really having fun here. It's really great singing with these guys. And I said, they just love the way you sing, man. They love sitting around. I like watching them watch you sing. And he said, well, you know, I'm the only real singer in the band. The other boys are all stylists. And he just said it so, like, offhanded, you know, like, and I laughed so hard. I thought it was so funny to hear him say that.
Tom Petty was not about to argue.
There will never be a voice like that again, I don't think. I'd never come across one. It's just to sit in a room and hear him sing. If you're just sitting on the sofa working on a song and Roy's singing, even when he sang soft, it's such a tone, such a sound, you know, such a gift, really. We used to always tell him, Roy, you must be the best singer in the world. And he'd say, yeah.
Maybe tomorrow, a new romance. No more sorrow, but that's the chance you gotta take. If your lonely heart breaks, only the lonely.
So when it was time to write a song to showcase Roy's voice, the challenge was set to provide him with a big number worthy of his vocal power and range.
All of Roy's big hits going back in the 60s, they were great tunes, you know, and they always had nice little bits and just great little hooks and different little bits. Like, Roy always seemed to have these extra little bits to the song. The structure was always quite different to other people's tunes. And it was hard, really, to get a song for Roy. I think when we were writing all these tunes, I dare say if we just kept sitting there, we could have rolled out another 30 tunes in the mood we got into. But Roy was like a special case to try and... In fact, that song originally, when we wrote that, and it wasn't very good when we first wrote it, and Jeff went home and did a bit of homework on it.
Not Alone Anymore was really... It was a very simple piece. Simple, I like simple, but this was simple beyond belief. It only had three chords all the way through. And somehow it wasn't... I felt... I'd taken a tape home and listened to it, and it was driving me nuts because it wasn't doing Roy justice. And I thought, I'm going to have to change the chords to make the tune go somewhere. And I did, and I changed the chords. I changed nearly all the chords in the whole song. Went into the studio really early one day, like about 10 o'clock in the morning, with the engineer Richard Dodd. Double-tracked a Telecaster, playing these new chords, took all the other instruments out, all the other guitars and everything, played these new chords under Roy's voice, and it worked great, and suddenly the tune jumped into life, and then the other lads came in, and they just went, wow, that's great, amazing.
got some nice stuff there.
I put all I had into the project, but the other guys had visions of what I should sound like or what I should sing and things like that. So we didn't question each other. We just went right ahead. And it was a learning experience for me. So the doing of the album, that was my greatest time.
In addition to having one of the greatest singers of the 20th century, the Traveling Wilburys had in Bob Dylan one of its most important lyricists and a supreme example of a vocal stylist. Both of these gifts were highlighted in Tweeter and the Monkey Man.
Tweeter and the Monkey Man was like really Tom Petty and Bob. Well, Jeff and I were there too, but we just sit around in the kitchen and he, for some reason, was talking about all this stuff which didn't make much sense to me. You know, it was that Americana kind of stuff. And we got a tape cassette and put it on and then transcribed everything they were saying. It was just fantastic watching him do it because he had like one take warming himself up. And on take two, he sang that Tweeter and the Monkey Man right through. And then what he did was he changed some of the lyrics. Maybe in about four places he changed a couple of lines and improved them and dropped those lines in, and that's it.
Let's get the nail of souvenirs down.
An ambulance come rolling in, a state trooper close behind. Tweeter took his gun and tied him up and treated him unkind. Undercover cop was left tied up to a tree near the souvenir stand by the abandoned factory.
Huh?
Yeah.
I think it was good.
Okay.
The way he writes the words down, like very tiny, like a spider's written it. You know, you can't hardly read it. And that's the amazing thing. It's just unbelievable seeing how he did it. I mean, that for me was just amazing watching it because I had very little to do with writing that tune at all, except Jeff and I remembered a bit he did that he'd forgotten, which became that chorus.
Of a record conveying the atmosphere in which it was made, Traveling Wilburys Volume 1 was it. Both the bubbling energy and fun of the kitchen recordings burst out of the tracks. As Tom Petty remembers, Roy Orbison, despite being known for his emotional ballads and moody image, was an essential contributor to the good humour that characterised the sessions.
He has this image of the, you know, dark and lonely, and but he wasn't. Never seemed that way to me. He seemed like a very happy person and just full of life and really living every day and loved the Wilburys. I remember Roy's laugh the most, I think. That he had this beautiful laugh, kind of like...
Roy's laughter was really infectious, you know. You couldn't help but just join in. Roy, actually, he loved Monty Python. He knew all the sketches. He could do them by himself, and which he did. The one day, we'd driven out to the Central Station in downtown LA to do the filming for Handle We Care. And in the car on the way there, Roy was doing the sketches on his own and laughing his socks off, like giggling.
And talking of Monty Python, when it was decided to document the history of the Wilbury ancestors of Charlie T. Jr., Otis, Lefty, Lucky and Nelson, George asked Michael Palin to help reveal it.
He said, we're going to create some identity of our own. We call ourselves the Travelling Wilburys. And we just, you know, we've got to have a whole past. We've got to invent a character. We've got to invent a past. And when the album came out, he said, would you do a sleeve notes, kind of historical look at the Travelling Wilburys? So I wrote something to this effect, which appears on its... I haven't read this for a while. The original Wilburys were a stationary people who, realising that their civilization could not stand still forever, began to go for short walks. Not the travelling, as we now know it, but certainly as far as the corner and back. They must have taken to motion in much the same way as penguins were, the time taking to ledges. For the next we hear of them, they were going out for the day, often taking lunch or a picnic. Later, we don't as yet know how much later, some intrepid Wilburys began to go away for the weekend, leaving late Friday and coming back Sunday. It was they who evolved simple rhythmic forms to describe their adventures. And it went on a bit in that vein.
Well, it's all... tomorrow will bring, maybe a diamond ring.
Well, it's all right, even if they say you're wrong. Well, it's all right, sometimes you gotta be strong. Well, it's all right, as long as you got somewhere to lay. Well,
somewhere down the road when somebody plays
at the end of the line,
the purple haze.
Well, it's alright, even when push comes to shove.
With the new songs written and recorded in the kitchen, as Jeff Lynne explains, the tapes were taken to George's house in England for some extra touches before the album's completion.
After we'd finished in LA with all the basic tracks done, we all went to Fryer Park, carried on working on them, just adding little bits, that, like bits of piano, guitar solos here and there, harmonies, just generally finishing them off, you know, making them into records. It was a wonderful atmosphere because I think it was a lovely hot summer, at least for a few days. I was probably there working on it for a couple of months with George. We worked on it together after everybody had finished doing their bits, the production side of it, you know, the mixing and everything. But it was a wonderful thing, hanging out at Fryer Park on the lawn, playing cricket, having jolly cups of tea and doing that very English thing. It was a lovely time. Marvellous, some of the best days of my life, really.
So old school in its approach, it sounded cutting edge. Travelling Wilburys Volume 1 sold 3 million copies in the States alone. Sadly, its resounding success was marred by tragedy when Roy Orbison died suddenly of a heart attack on December the 6th, 1988, less than a month after the album's release. Just days later, the Wilburys came together to film a promotional video for the follow-up to Handle With Care. As they mimed to End of the Line, Roy's absence was poignantly portrayed by a guitar resting on a rocking chair.
His funeral, I think, was only about a day before the video. But we just tried to, you know, go on and hope that we did him justice. And it turned out to be a curious song for the next single, you know, The End of the Line. But you write these songs, and then it's funny how events come down, and later on when you hear the song, it can mean so much more than it did when you were writing it. It was, and still is, unusual to have him gone, but I think Roy's okay for some reason, wherever he is. I've always felt that if anybody was ever prepared to leave, Roy was, you know. He was a very deep man, and he had lived a lot, and he was a very wise man. But I think Roy went out on top, and I'm sure he knew that, I think the last conversation I had with him was a couple of days before he died on the phone, and he was just so thrilled that the Wilburys had gone platinum, and he was just, isn't it great? It's great, you know.
Roy's widow, Barbara Orbison.
You know, for the first time in the mid-80s, in 85, I heard Roy say, I want to be on top again. I want to have a number one album, a number one single. I had never heard him say that, and we had been married by that time, probably 15 years. So the journey began. Roy was, as somebody said, the glue of the Wilburys. You know, when you were around Roy, Roy was just one way, and that was he had incredible personal integrity, and he just had to pull up a notch. And it wasn't that he would say anything. Roy just brought that out in all of us. And Roy just knew. He never got to see Billboard, but he knew in his heart that it was just a great time for him.
The success of Traveling Wilburys Volume 1 and Roy Orbison's death prompted two questions. First, would there be another Wilburys record? And second, if there were to be another, who might join the remaining four? Plausible names like Del Shannon and Roger McGuinn were rumoured, but within the group itself, there was no such discussion.
No, we didn't talk about it at all. We just waited until we decided to do a new album, and then there's still only four of us, so we got in the room together, just got the guitars out and started writing a new one. So, you know, to contrive to have somebody else in it, I mean, there's a lot of people it'd be nice to have in occasionally or do a tune with somebody else, but I think there was enough singers and songwriters anyway, even with Roy gone.
Where were you?
As before, the second album, mischievously called Volume 3, was recorded away from a conventional recording studio. But this time, instead of invading a friend's kitchen, the Wilburys took to the hills.
It was a most amazing place which we rented because we'd done really well with the first album. We became posh and thought we'd have our own studio and build it ourselves in this house that we rented. And it was good fun, actually. It was tremendous to have this house and the great gardens to walk around in, you know, when you wanted a break. The setup was drums in the hall with a great big settee across to baffle it from the guitars. We all played live, and that's how it was. I think we were actually in the library with a sofa between us and Jim Keltner.
So we got to write them to a point where we like them, where we can derive an enjoyment from them and have a little smile at the same time. And I think if we can achieve that, then other people out there who are of similar kind of mentality will, it's going to like it too, hopefully. Well, I mean, the first one we wrote was Inside Out, and that was within, I mean, this is from everybody arriving at the house within an hour. we had that song written. Not the lyrics, but we had the format for the tune. Then we went out, put it down on tape. And, you know, one take, two takes maybe, to get it. And then we went on, wrote another song. One day we did like five tunes in 2.5 hours. And then later when we got all the basic tracks of, you know, we had about 15 songs and we thought, well, we better write the words. We sit down with a pencil and paper and come up with an idea of what it's about and start the lyrics. Like, for instance, Inside Out, we came to write the words of that. Somebody like Bob, maybe, I can't remember if it was Bob or Tom, would say, look out your window, just came up with the idea, look out your window, the grass ain't green. And then I just thought of, it's kind of yellow. And then somebody else says, see what I mean? And then we've got the next bit. Look up your chimney, the sky in blue, it's kind of yellow. I mean, then that one became a joke because every time the third line came, it kept being yellow. It's kind of yellow.
Look into the future with your mystic crystal ball. See if it ain't yellow. See if it's there at all.
Upside right.
Upside up.
Yeah, don't it make you wanna twist and shout when you're inside out?
Inside out. Right
inside
up.
Yeah, don't it make you wanna twist and shout when you're inside out?
Although jokey in spirit, Inside Out did have a serious message about the damage being done to the environment. Another song from the sessions drew attention to a human tragedy in Eastern Europe. Olivia Harrison had been strongly affected by the disturbing images broadcast on TV news of abandoned children in the orphanages of Romania.
In April 1990, I was in Bucharest, found myself trying to do something for a lot of the abandoned children in Romania. And I called George, and they were already in the house recording in Los Angeles. And I said, oh, you know, actually it was Dave Stewart had given me a record saying, why don't you do an album? Here's a song, and handed me a cassette. You know, you can use this. So when I spoke to George a few days later, you know, I said, if you happen to have any time and you just think, you know, there's a song or something you want to do, we could do a single and then we'd have two sides. And then 12 hours later, you know, George and I spoke on the phone again. He said, hey, you know, we went into the studio last night and we recorded a song for you. And it was Nobody's Child.
In every town and village, there are places just like this, with rows and rows of children, babies in their cribs. They've long since stopped the crying, as no one ever hears, and no one's there to notice them or take away the fears. Nobody's child. Nobody's child. Just like a flower, they're growing wild.
Got no mommy's kisses and no daddy's smile. Nobody wants them. They're nobody's child. Nobody wants them. They're nobody's child.
George had remembered the appropriate song Nobody's Child from a version by British skiffle star Lonnie Donegan and adapted it by writing a new verse about the orphans.
One person wrote about Nobody's Child, which was done very fast, and it was just like a country tune. You know, obviously, if you're not interested in Dylan and me and Petty and Jeff Lynne, then, you know, you're not interested in it. But for them to say we're a bunch of old farts, well, they're right, we are a bunch of old farts, but listen to the music that's being played on radio now and all this stuff that's in the Hit Parade. I mean, everybody's got the same drum sound. Everybody's got the same keyboard sound. You listen to the New Blue Moon on there, yeah, which was played live with four acoustic guitars and the drummer. I mean, that was all played live, and the sound of it's good. We put two microphones on the drums. I mean, these days, even if they do have a real drummer, you go in the control room and they've got like 12 or 14 tracks of drums. And I'm waiting, looking for a new.
Traveling Wilburys Volume 3 was released in 1990, 2 years after its predecessor, the inevitable question popped up about whether there might be a tour.
When there was a meeting about touring, and I think they talked a lot about it, and I think, you know, once you start talking about touring, the managers are there, and a lot of dates, a lot of things came up, and, you know, all the various things you need to make a tour, and suddenly one of the managers said, it'll be really easy. George said, as easy as lying in a hammock. And I think one of the other guys said, that's when we knew there was not going to be a tour.
And as it turned out, there were no more recordings by the Traveling Wilburys. And surprisingly, in an age when it seems almost anything ever recorded is on a CD, for many years their two albums have been unavailable.
I think the Wilbury music has been unavailable since 1995. I think George had a deal. His deal ran out in 1995, and sometime in about 1998, he was in a record store in Boston, and he called someone and said, "Hey, you know, there's none of my records in the store at all." And he said, "Well, do you have a distribution deal, George?" And he said, "No, I don't think so." And he goes, "That'll be why they're not there." So he'd just been busy doing other things. You know, it wasn't really a big priority, but the re-release of the Wilburys was one of the things George had on his list to do. It's something that he would have done.
Okay, I'm starting.
Wilbury's version of Del Shannon's classic Runaway first appeared as an extra song on a single, but is now one of the four bonus tracks included in a special reissue package of the two albums and a DVD. Jeff Lynne has been working on these songs.
One of them is Runaway. It's been remixed, though, and it has the real solo on it this time, the actual clavulane, just like the original. I managed to find a clavulane on eBay. I got two of them. because they were there, you know. And then the other songs, there's a song called Like a Ship, which is a big kind of folk song, and Maxine, which is a rollicking one, like a kind of Latin American type of thing. They've got lots of fun things, you know, they're very interesting.
It was late in the morning of November. She was loading up a wagon in the rain. She said she'd be back in the morning, but she never came through here again. I'd see her in the market. She never had much to spend. These days the market's an old parking lot, and she never came through here again. Maxine, 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 Maxine. Time plays tricks on your memory. It's been a long weekend. She said she'd be back here by Monday, but never came through here again. Some say your soul surrendered, and someone took her in. They found her blue shipwrecky on the ground, and she never came through here again. Maxine, 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 Maxine.
Okay, that's it.
Issued 17 years after it first began to take shape, Maxine completed at last. The two albums by the Travelling Wilburys feature remarkable music, created by a group of friends determined to have some fun.
It was a wonderful time, and completely accidental, really. We couldn't have ever planned it or handpicked who would be the Wilburys. It just happened, you know. I think the one thing I remember is just there was never a negative moment doing that. We really enjoyed that. I think we made it for us, really, because I love all those guys. We were all pretty good friends, and we just enjoyed each other's company, really. At times, it seemed like the album was just an excuse to all hang around with each other, really.
It's just the attitude of now we're going to have one for ourselves rather than worry about all these record labels and hit parades. The Wilburys, musically, is like the Green Party. We've got to battle against all these whales that are stuck in blocks of ice, namely the music business, and release all these people from feeling guilty for not having a synthesizer and not being able to program it. The pop world is like a budgerigar sitting on a little perch, and he has a little mirror and he looks at himself and he keeps tapping his beak on his own reflection, saying, ooh, you know, who's Pretty Polly? It's more fun to hang out with a few friends and just do something and sod it, you know, just do it.
You couldn't wish for more than the Wilburys, you know?
I like the Wilburys then, do you, Jeff?
What do you think?
You know, I think they're not all the crack up.
No.
You put your hand on your head,
put your foot in the air,
then you hop around the room,
hop around the room,
in your underwear.
In your underwear.
There ain't never been nothing quite like this. Come on, baby, it's the Wilbury twist. Lift your other foot up, fall on your ass,
get back up,
put your teeth in the glass. Ain't never been nothing quite like this. It's a magical thing called the Wilbury twist.
Travelling Wilburys Revisited was written and produced by Kevin Howlett and is an independent production for BBC Radio 2 by Howlett Media Productions. I'm Bob Harris. Thanks for listening.
Everybody's trying to do the Wilburys with.
As the Wilburys began to go further and further in their search for musical inspiration, they found themselves the object of interest among many less developed species, nightclub owners, tour operators and recording executives. To the Wilburys, who had only just learned to cope with wives, rodeos and drummers, it was a blow from which many of them never recovered. They became hairdressers or TV rental salespersons. but a tiny handful survive. The last of the Travelling Wilburys, and the songs gathered here represent the popular laments, the epic and heroic tales which characterise the apotheosis of the elusive Wilbury sound. The message of the music travels, as indeed they travel, and as I must travel now for further treatment. Good listening, good night, and let thy will be done.